Yes. It's not working yet. Maybe it will soon. Technology is so wonderful. Ah, there it is. There it goes. Now everything's working again. Okay.
I came in this morning intending to do one lesson,
and then I went to the worship service. Did you just go to the worship service? Well, I want to share with you about a half a dozen things that may add a little bit to what you experienced in the worship service this morning. First of all, does anybody recognize what that's a part of? It's a periodic table. I'm a chemistry professor, and when I'm not doing things that they make me do, I'm doing things I want to do, and that means I'm teaching students about chemistry, and this is one of the things that we use. It's not exactly a cathedral, but it's probably one of the most magnificent structures that human beings have ever put together with the things that God made, because it organizes so much information. And I want to just take a minute to show you a couple of things and maybe try to make this make sense with what you've heard in the worship service this morning. It will fit better than other things. Helium is the element whose symbol is located here. And helium has a distinction. I believe I'm correct on this. Helium is the only element that was discovered not on Earth. Its original discovery was not terrestrial. It was not on Earth. People had learned to look at sources of light with stuff between them and the source of light, and the stuff that's in between could absorb some of the light, and then you look at the light that's absorbed and you make some conclusions about what the stuff was. That's called spectroscopy. People had learned a little bit about this, and when they looked at the light of the sun, they could see certain colors of light, certain frequencies of light missing, and they could line up a lot of those with hydrogen, so they knew hydrogen was in the sun. But there were some frequencies that hydrogen didn't absorb and that nothing they knew about absorbed, and they were clearly being absorbed. And so their conclusion was there's something in or on the sun between us and the main light source of the sun. And whatever that is, we don't know what it is. So they named the element helium. Now the naming of that element helium is extremely interesting, because the IUM ending is mainly reserved for things over here, which have a certain kind of property. And since they didn't know what helium was, they put an IUM ending. Everybody else in this column has an OM ending. Neon, argon, krypton, xenon, etc. Those all have an ON ending. Helium doesn't, because when people first discovered it, they didn't have any of it to look at because it was 93 million miles away. They later found some in gas wells in Texas, and then found some in lots and lots of other places, and so it's well known now. But it was first observed there. Now, helium is one of a series of elements in this column which collectively have a name. Do you know that name? Noble or inert gases. Okay. Do you know who John Madden is? My wife specifically detests John Madden's voice. She does not like to listen to John Madden, and some of you may share that particular affliction. I think the guy's funny, but I recognize that his voice can be annoying. In any event, there was one night, probably 15 years ago, he was doing a Monday night football game, and the game was deadly dull. Now, what do the announcers have to do when a game is deadly dull? They have to do something to keep the interest back, right? So Madden had the cameraman ignore everything that's going on the field and just focus in on one player. And he focused in on this huge lineman. And he says, you know what's hilarious? This guy, and the camera's zooming in on him, he looks like a mountain, right? Big, huge, 300-pound guy. He says, he is an all-pro lineman, one of the best in the game. But he doesn't want to be a lineman. He wants to be a wide receiver. He wants to sprint down the field like a gazelle and catch passes like that. He'd never do it in his life, but that's what he really wants to do. And he had the camera move to another player. This time I think it was a cornerback. He said, this guy, what he really wants to be is to be a defensive tackle. Now, this guy, maybe 5'10", 180, something like that. But what he really wants to be down the line, messing up. And he started moving from person to person across the field, both sides, both teams. And he zoomed in, and every one of them, whatever they were, they wanted to be something else. And he says, I've come to a conclusion. There is no one in the NFL who's actually doing what they really want to do. They're all doing something else. I thought that was an amazing statement. And I put these two things together. Because what's interesting about this column of elements is they're the only ones that are doing what they want to do. Everybody else wants to do what they're doing. And if you understand that, there's a whole lot of chemistry that's up, comes into focus. Let me help you with this. The little number that's up there is the number of electrons that this atom has. So helium has
two electrons.
Neon has two electrons. When I'm in a class, I try to encourage a particular student not to give me all the answers so they understand. If fluorine wants to be doing what neon is doing, fluorine has to change. How does fluorine have to change? Has to gain one more electron. And much of the chemistry of fluorine can be understood if you just know that one thing. When you see fluorine, it isn't doing what it wants to do. It wants to do things with one more electron than it has. So far, okay? What about oxygen?
You're correct.
And therefore?
It needs to
run. Right. Oxygen's not going to be happy like it is. It wants to be something else. It has to change in order to be that, right? What about sodium? It's got one too many. It has to lose one. And everybody on the periodic chart, except for the elements in here, they have to change in order to be happy. Every one of them. Isn't that interesting? When I teach this, and I've been teaching this for more than 30 years, I read to my students Luke 7, 31 to 35. And I quote to them that Jesus, 2,000 years ago, caught the flavor of this. When he said there were children in the marketplace, and they said to the other children, we tried to play a wedding with you and you wouldn't be happy. And we tried to play a funeral and you wouldn't be sad. We can't do anything with you. So what are those children that you can't do anything with acting like? They're acting like noble gases. Because elements in here say, I'd like to gain electrons. And elements over here say, I'd like to lose electrons. And these are the only elements on here I've tried. Let's say, I'm not going to do anything with you. That's the noble part. That's the inert part. So far, okay? I got one more step. You ready? What occurred to me, as I was listening to Travis Collins at my hour this morning, was there's a spiritual periodic chart. And in the spiritual periodic chart, we all have a place. And none of us is what we not want, need to be. None of us. Except one. There's one noble gas in the spiritual periodic chart. Who's that? And if we're going to do what we need to do, what do we have to do? We have to change so as to become like Him. You seeing a point of this yet? So what kind of change do we have to do? Some of us might need to lose some things out of our lives. Some might need to lose some more. So that the things that are really important have a chance to grow and thrive. And that was the story 2 weeks ago when he talked about thorns choking things up. Some of us need to add some things. There's a hole in our lives. And only the Lord and the Lord's work can fill it. And some of us need to fill a little bit more than others. But not one of us, as we were, is where we need to be. Every one of us needs to change. And it just occurred to me that maybe you need a little lesson about the periodic chart before I let you go with what you heard in the sermon this morning. I'm weird. That's what I think about when I hear things. Okay, enough of that. Let's go back to the lesson for today. I had somebody ask me, do you tell people ahead of time what you're doing in the lesson? And I said, yes, I do. Every time I know what I'm going to do next, I tell them. Did I tell you what we're going to do today? I didn't know, but now I know. I want you to turn to Hebrews chapter 10. And as you're turning there, I want to tell you that I had an interesting experience yesterday. I had a salad for supper. I don't eat salads of my own volition, except when I'm feeling particularly guilty about what I need to do and don't do. But my wife provided me with a salad last night. And it had something in it which my salads have not had for almost 5, maybe 6 weeks now. That's spinach, yes. It was back in the stores. Have you heard the story of what went wrong in that one? They claim it's one field in California that caused the problems. Wild boars came up and did their business on the edge of the field, and that contaminated just a few leaves of spinach around the outside, and that's why everybody across the country got sick.
Right.
Yeah, right. Wild boars doing their thing. And anyway, we had spinach. For 5 weeks, 6 weeks, we've not had spinach. So what have we had in our salads for the last 5 or 6 weeks? Lettuce. That's the subject for this morning. So let's turn to Hebrews chapter 10. In Hebrews chapter 7 and 8 and the first part of chapter 10, the writer of Hebrews has been talking about how Jesus is our high priest. The sanctuary he has gone into is not the sanctuary on earth, but the sanctuary in heaven. The sacrifice he's taken in is not an earthly sacrifice whose effects do not last. It was his own blood, and it's a sacrifice that was done once and for all. And so, verse 19 of chapter 10 says, "We have then, brothers, complete confidence through the blood of Jesus in entering the sanctuary by a new way which he has opened for us, a living opening through the curtain, that is to say, his flesh. And we have the high priest over the sanctuary of God. So as we go in," what does it say?
Let
us. What does it say at the first of verse 23? Let us. First of verse 24. And the middle of verse 25, most translations will have, let us. So we're going to talk about let us this morning. Okay? It's good, isn't it? You like that? Yeah. Thank you. Now, the truth of this is I did this about 2 years ago, but those of you who were here then have forgotten that I did it.
Yeah, we have.
But it's worth bringing up again. Okay. Verse 22 is the first time that little phrase appears. And let me just tell you right now where we're going with this. If you watch that little phrase and think about what it's trying to say, what you find is from this point forward, almost the rest of the book of Hebrews is continuing to throw these out. Sometimes it says it, sometimes it's implied. My translation, for example, doesn't put it in verse 25. Many translations do. Mine doesn't, but it's certainly implied there. Okay. Now, I didn't know I would get the front end that I got in this hour. I didn't get it in the first hour. I want you to think back for just a minute. We had a time listing things that we need to pray about with each other, right? And just before we prayed, my brother Jeff said two things. Do you remember what he said? Let us go to the Lord in prayer. Let's encourage one another. That was a good phrase, Jeff. It was exactly right. There are things we ought to be doing, and let's encourage us to do it. Because it's the support system that we have. When we're sick, or when somebody really close to us is sick, let's encourage one another. when a brother is looking for a job, let's encourage one another. When times are good, let's remind each other that God's the reason that times are good. And that God is still God and we're still brothers and sisters whether times are good or not. Let's go through these. What does the first one say? Let us what?
Draw near to God. And it says some qualifications with that.
With what?
Mine says a sincere heart. What does yours say?
A true
heart, I think one translation says.
And what else? I think there's something else it says.
Yeah, mine says filled with faith. Sincere or true heart filled with faith. It's heart filled with faith. I think one translation says full of assurance of faith. Don't leave off the of faith at the end. Now, having said that, for at least the next 2 weeks and possibly the next 6 or 7, that's what we're going to be examining, and that's why I came to this part, and that's why I found this and thought I would start with this. I want to talk about faith for a little while, the nature of faith and some of the things that we need to know about that. But this looked like to me to be a good way of starting into this. Mine goes on to say, there's a lot talking about the heart, isn't there? Sincere in heart, filled with faith, our hearts sprinkled and free from any trace of bad conscience, our bodies washed with pure water. So it talks about our hearts sprinkled and our bodies washed with pure water. Let's start at the very front end. How does this one begin? Let us go back to Genesis. Adam and Eve have eaten the fruit. God comes to walk in the garden, it says in one place, in the cool of the day. And he doesn't find Adam coming to meet him. And he says, Adam, where are you? Do you think God didn't know? Not me. So why did he say it? Adam needed to know he was in the wrong place. What was Adam doing? Hiding from God. When you don't do the right thing, what's the human tendency? What's the human response? That you become you duck and cover and you run. So this is not necessarily the natural human thing to do.
Well, our small groups do it looking in the bus. God was closer than you think. Mm-hmm. And the author talks about the Michelangelo portrait of God and Adam. And how God is framing for Adam. And we looked at the picture last week. But Adam is, he's not sure. God leaves Adam the choice of touching him. It's very powerful.
If you're going to draw near to God, some things are required. Sincerity of heart. I had a person who has been in our class but is now out teaching in another part of the church. He came to me this morning. He says, I'm really struggling with something. When it talks about the heart in the Old Testament, what's it talking about? It can't be talking about this organ, this muscle in the middle of my body that pumps blood. What's it talking about? What would your response have been to that question? When the Bible talks about the heart, what's it talking about?
It talks about the inner being of the person. Not so much as the heart itself, as you said, the physical, but the soul.
Okay. I told him that it seemed to me that all that was talking about was probably for us, to the extent there's a physical location, was in the brain. But you can talk about an intellectual component, you can talk about an emotional component, you can talk about a spiritual component. And typically when you talk about the heart, you're talking about more of the emotional and spiritual part of people. Right? So when it talks about a sincerity of heart, what it says is you're not hiding anything back. You're open, transparent to God. I remember hearing a fellow come to our church a few years ago, and he spent several Wednesday nights talking about transparency or openness to where God's light can go through you and illuminate all parts. That's very hard to do. So how is it accomplished?
When he talks about hearts sprinkled and bodies washed, what's the difference between sprinkling and washing? Any Methodists or Presbyterians in here? Yeah, I don't think that's the difference he's talking about, because I don't think they knew the difference between Methodists and Baptists back in those days. I think he's talking about something else. What did you do with the blood of the sacrifice if you were the high priest? Sprinkled it where? On the altar, right?
Our hearts sprinkled. Our hearts become an altar. We have sacrificed to God. Maybe that's what it's talking about. The part about bodies washed with pure water, we don't think of baptism as Baptist, as itself saving us, but we think of it as what? As a symbol of something that has happened. But in that process, there is a purification comes when you have yielded to God in obedience. And I think that's the key. There's an obedience that's involved with that. When you have done that, you've begun to take physical action to put yourself right with God, to begin to listen to what He says and begin to do that. I think some mix of that is what we're talking about. What's the second one in verse 23?
Old ones struggling to the hope
we profess. Yeah, mine says, keep firm to the hope we profess.
Keep firm, I-R-M, to the hope we profess. But there is a translation that says, hold unswervingly, is that right? Yeah, some will say hold fast. Some will say unswervingly to the hope we profess.
About four things in there I want to point out to you.
First of all, unswerving. I think I caught Barbara off guard in the first hour, and I won't catch her off guard this hour. That word conjures up some very strong memories for me. There was a time when Interstate 75 was not complete from Florida to Detroit. Between Knoxville and Chattanooga and Atlanta, there were big sections that were not complete. Between Atlanta and the Florida-Georgia line, there were big sections that weren't complete. And so you'd be on the interstate for a while, and you'd get off the interstate for a while. We were living in Gainesville. My parents lived just outside of Knoxville, so when we went to see my folks, we'd drive what would now be Interstate 75, but you'd have to be off on the blue roads, as they used to call them. Well, one of the places, I don't remember now if it's 41 or 411, there was a 4 in the number somewhere. We were off of Interstate 75. We were on a four-lane divided road, and it had a median strip. But every time an intersecting road would come, then there would be a paved area across the median strip where somebody could cross that road. Now, I was going 75 on what would eventually be 75, and there was a car approaching from my right to a stop sign. The car was a Chrysler station wagon, behind which, on a trailer, was a boat that was between 25 and 30 feet long. He didn't stop for the stop sign. Instead, he pulled his Chrysler station wagon into this paved area in the median strip, leaving his boat across the whole road. Okay? And I wasn't as close as that wall, but I was as close as the next wall back there, and I was going 75. On that day, we swerved. And somehow, I didn't hit him. Bobby Labonte or Jeff Burton or somebody came in the car with me and drove for a while. I can remember looking back on it, doing some things that I didn't know that I knew to do, which was, I turned the wheel all the way to one side and put it into a skid, and then I straightened it up and hit the accelerator so that I accelerated into the road that he came on, put it into another skid as I came into that road, and then fishtailed down the road. And, you know, Barbara just closed her eyes and screamed. And so, but we swerved that day. But there was another day, years later, there was another day when we did not swerve.
This was on Mount Rainier. Actually, the slopes of Mount Rainier, because you can't get up on Mount Rainier in a car. But we were driving up Mount Rainier on a road, and there was a deer came across the road. And I slowed down. That was a smart thing to do, I thought. And we were getting pretty close to the deer, maybe as close as from here to the second row there. And the deer had cleared the road and was over here on the side. And I pressed down on the accelerator to accelerate past the deer. The sound of my engine appears to startle deers. I didn't know that. And the deer did something that I had never seen a deer do. He jumped into the air, turned 180 degrees, and moved so that he came down in front of my van. And I hit him at about 45 miles an hour. Luckily, I was in an Astro van, so that when I hit him, he rolled down into the radiator and took out the engine, as opposed to up into the windshield and taking out me and my family. But, you know, pretty much ruined the car. They sent us a tow truck. They towed us about 150 miles to Chehalis, Washington, over on Interstate 5, I think it is. You can look on a map and see it. And when I got there, my State Farm agent met me. I did not know I had a State Farm agent in Chehalis, Washington, but it turned out I did. I had phoned State Farm, and they had said, we'll have somebody meet you, and he was my agent. And he told me something fascinating. He said, it's a good thing you didn't swerve. And I said, oh? He said, yes. If it had been a cow or a horse or a dog and you hit it and you didn't try to swerve to miss it, then the wreck would have been your fault. You would have had great increases in your rates. You would have paid huge deductibles. But a deer doing what the deer did, that's an act of God. It'd be like lightning hitting your car. Therefore, if you had swerved and flipped your van, all the damage would have been yours, and you would have paid huge deductibles, and your rates would have gone up. But hitting the deer, there are no deductibles, there are no charges. We fix everything for free as quickly as we can, and they did. I didn't know that. Well, it was true 6 months later when Barbara hit a deer. By then, we knew she didn't swerve, hit that deer, same Astro van, down into the radiator, took out the engine. True story. 6 months later, I went into the State Farm place. This was back in Richmond. I went into the State Farm place, and I said, I don't believe this. This is two times in 6 months. And this really nice woman looked at me and said, yeah, but you didn't swerve. I said, that's right, we didn't. She said, well, odds are, statistics says there has to be somebody hits two deer in 6 months. Looks like it was you. No charges, no deductibles to pay, no increases in rate. Now, I don't think that has a thing to do with this, but I thought that was a funny story. Because what I want you to do now is tie this into the sermon this morning. Travis Collins made some very, very important points about how does a church approach the culture. And if you heard what he said, and it matches up with what I heard, then you heard something like this. There are some things we have to hold on to. And there are some things that are on the outside that we can change in order to try to attract people to the gospel and to what we understand and to try to reach out to them where they are. And it's pretty important for us to know which is which. This one doesn't say, hold unswervingly to everything the church has ever been or does. What does it say? Hold unswervingly to one thing. What's that? No, it's not hope. It's what? Look at all the words.
Confession.
The hope we profess. You know what my title is where I work? I am a professor. What's my job? I profess. And I profess chemistry. What's my job in professing chemistry? I'm supposed to take some people who don't know anything about chemistry, about as much as they need to, and I'm supposed to, on the basis of things I've studied and things I know, try to help them understand that a little bit better. Do you know people who have a hope but never profess it? You know people who profess all kinds of things, but it's never has a whole lot to do with hope of this kind anyway. What we need to hold on to is what's at the heart of our relationship with God, which is Jesus died for me. And I've accepted that. And I've trusted Jesus with my soul, both now and forever. And I've opened my heart to His leadership, and I'm trying to be subject to that. That's the heart of my hope.
That's what I need to keep on to.
If it's a horse or a cow, swerve that thing. Do you see the connection with what Travis was talking about? He talked about, you know, what do you do in a church to attract people in? Do we go to marketing techniques and all that? And the answer is up to a point, yeah. And we've done some things in our church to try to make things more attractive. But there's some things we don't. How many of you know about the series Hot Topics that Travis has done? I think it's two summers worth. You may not have made all of them, but you may have read some of those, and that's okay, because he was so concerned that people quote him accurately that he wrote it all down and then read it to us and then made very few comments, because otherwise he's going to get misquoted somewhere. But if you watch, there was a theme through. It was 2 years worth of those, four per year. I think there's been eight of those yet. There's a theme that runs through most of those, and that theme is, you know, there's a whole crowd trying to push us this way, there's a whole crowd trying to push us this way. And pushing us this way here is okay, pushing us that way there is okay, but there's a place here. And that's the place I'm going to hold on to, and I hope this church does too. Something of that is in here. Paul says at one point, becoming all things to all men, so that by all means I might at least save some. But also this. What's the third thing? This is verse 24. I like this verse. This is the best of all in this little section, I think. How does yours read that first little phrase?
Consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds.
Consider how we may spur one another on to love and good deeds. My translation sure has the last of that. It's got a little bit different in the front end of that. Listen to this. Let us be concerned for each other to stir a response in love and good works. It's that phrase at the front, concerned about each other. Our class has a tendency to grow. We'll grow for a while, and then there are people who feel called to service, and they'll go out to service, and we'll shrink back down a little bit, and then we'll grow a bit more. I've looked at why that is, and I think more than anything else, it is that people in this group start to care about each other. And they come on Sunday morning, and they see their friends, and they're encouraged by that. The thing that worries me is we've gotten big enough that every once in a while somebody can be gone for a little while. And if I'm not careful, I may not notice that this particular one is gone, because I'm so happy to see all the ones who are here. I've got to work on that. But I love the idea of this being in the list. Let's be concerned about each other.
And then from there, stirring up, my translation says, Bobby, what did yours say again? Yours has a verb in there.
Spur. Consider how we may spur.
Spur says, you're on a horse, and you're kicking the plants or something like that. Stir up. Right?
What it says is, you know, encourage them to some kind of action. Action that begins in love and extends into good deeds.
Or good works.
What's the one in verse 25? There's a front end. Do not absent yourselves from your own assemblies as some do, but exhort, encourage one another. The more so as you see the day drawing near, and the day is capitalized in mine. Is it capitalized in yours?
Let's gather together on some kind of regular basis. Let's not forsake the assembling of ourselves together, I think King James said. We ought to come together. And what's our purpose of coming together? To encourage each other. I think there's a little repetition in there. I think some of the one that's in 3 is in 4 as well.
I think some of what's in 3 is in 4 as well. Now, having said that, I've got a total of 8 or 9 listed here, and that's only 4. So let's go see if we can chase a couple more. Does anybody know what chapter 11 in Hebrews is talking about? The front end of that says, only faith can guarantee the blessings that we hope for or prove the existence of realities that are unseen. It is for their faith that our ancestors are acknowledged, and off it goes into a list of those, right? You can almost hear them say, let's remember the faithful people that went before us. Let's remember God's faithful servants. Do we have any folks like that in our church we can look at? He's getting a little bit old. He's getting a little bit feeble. You may not know Cliff Allison the way I do. But if you know Cliff Allison, we got one. I think we got more than one, but we got one. Somebody that I think does these kinds of things to encourage and help others. But here's what I want you to see. I want you to go over to verse 32 in chapter 11. The opening phrase in my translation of verse 32 is, what more shall I say? And I think what the writer is trying to say is this. There's no way I can deal with all the ones I ought to deal with. How can I talk about all the people that I ought to talk about in this regard? He says, there's not time for me to give an account of Gideon or Barak or Samson or Jephthah or of David or Samuel or the prophets. And you have to go back to the Old Testament and sort of see who some of those folks were. These were men. I want you to listen to his description of these people. And what I want you to listen for is, do you hear a change partway through here? These were the men who through faith conquered kingdoms, did what is upright, and earned the promises. They could keep a lion's mouth shut, put out blazing fires, and emerged unscathed from battle. They were weak people. That sounded odd. Who were given strength. Oh, okay. To be brave in war and drive back foreign invaders. Some returned to their wives from the dead by resurrection. So far, so good. But then it starts to change. While others submitted to torture, refusing release so that they would rise again to a better life. Some had to bear being pilloried and flogged or chained up in prison. They were stoned or sawn in half. People think that phrase applies to Isaiah. Or killed by the sword. They were homeless and wore only the skins of sheep and goats. They were in want and hardship and maltreated. That's a pretty long way from conquered kingdoms and shut lions' mouths and emerged unscathed from battle, right? Okay, listen to what the writer is saying. When you start looking at people who live their lives with faith, you see some who had what the world would see as success, but you have to look hard to spot the ones that are there. Because some of them, the world would never have recognized them as a success. Some of them, the world would never have recognized it. And then in verse 38, he gives God's judgment. They were too good for the world. And they wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and ravines. We ought to remember the faithful servants of God who went before us and learn from their example. Chapter 12. Verse 1. Now he's talked about all these people of faith, and then he says this, with so many witnesses and a great cloud all around him. It's as if he's saying, okay, you've seen all these people and all the ones more that I don't have time to talk about. They're all watching us today. And my translation says, we too then should. But your translation may say, let us. Take us a little while to find this next one, but there it sits. Let us.
So what's this one?
Throw off the things that hinder.
Anybody see a connection to this? What happened before sodium? You had to throw one off or... magnesium might have to throw two off to get to where they did what they needed to do. There's a corollary. There's a parallel. Throw off the things that hinder. What else?
Throw off things that hinder, specifically the sin that clings so closely. And then what does it say next?
Let us run.
Let us run. That's a little lettuce, but it's all sort of the same thing, so I'm going to keep it in this number. Let us run. Run how?
Mine has an adverb, I think it is, or adjective there. Somehow. Mine says with perseverance. What does that mean?
Sitting about right here in the prayer list for the first hour was a praise for a young woman by the name of Whitney Anderson.
Whitney Anderson ran the Chicago Marathon in 4 hours and 20 minutes, something like that. Pretty impressive, wasn't it? How'd you do?
4:30.
She was right at your time. That's pretty good. To do a marathon is still amazing. You know this guy did one? You know this guy's done. You're going to try again this year, right? Run with perseverance. The race that is set before us. And then what's the last part? This is verse 2. Mine has a let us at the front of verse 2.
Keep your eyes on
Jesus. And what does it say about Jesus? King James says, the author and the finisher of our faith. Perfector, here says. A long time ago, I had a chance to go to one of the United States garden spots. If you ever get the chance, I just encourage you to take the chance to do this. Fort Benning, Georgia. Wonderful place. I thoroughly enjoyed my experience there. That's a lot. I knew when I went, I was going to be going through basic training. And I knew that I was going to be doing something that I didn't do much. I was going to be running. I was going to be marching. And so, in order to get ready for this, I did exactly what I thought I should do. I got myself some tennis shoes and some shorts, and I went out and did a little running. And I got there, and I found out they didn't let me run in tennis shoes. What did they make me run in?
Boots.
And not just boots, combat boots. And it turned out they didn't let me run in shorts. Because they had this thing of thinking that people ought to be able to get from one place to another pretty fast while they had all their gear on. And not just their gear, but the things that the group had to carry. Well, the group had to carry. And somehow they kept looking at me and thinking, you look like the fellow that ought to carry the 60-pound radio. In addition to your field gear and your weapon and your entrenching tool and all that stuff. And on the days they were feeling particularly kind, they would let me carry the 55-pound M60 machine gun because they thought that looked like something I ought to carry as well. And you know what I found out? I found out that wearing shorts and tennis shoes was not an adequate preparation. How do people prepare for stuff like that? Well, the answer is they put on combat boots and they put on backpacks with textbooks in them. That was funny. Think about that one. See the little kids going to school. Now, if somebody wants to really run a race, then what happens? You drop the weights and then you can fly. Sometimes in the training part, the weights come in. I don't know exactly how all this fits together, but I think they're saying if you've begun to learn how the Lord works and now you can start to get rid of the things that really weigh you down, you're going to be able to fly.
Bill,
yeah.
It relates back to the perseverance.
Oh, yeah.
And then the last part of that verse, too, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. There has to be a reason.
Verse 3, think of the way he persevered against such opposition for sinners, and then you will not lose heart and come to grief when it's your turn. There's a whole lot more that we ought to do, but I want to, in the interest of time, go to the last one that I want to talk about then. I want you to take a look at verse 14 of chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 14. There is no permanent city here for us. We're looking for the one which is yet to be. This isn't our home. Our experience on earth is preparation for our eternal home. Through him, then, let us, mine says, does yours?
Mm-hmm.
Offer God an unending sacrifice of praise, the fruit of the lips of those who acknowledge His name. I see a bunch of lettuces running across here. Let us keep doing good works. Let us keep sharing our resources, for those are the kinds of sacrifices that please God. Let us offer God an unending sacrifice of praise. Praise is honoring God for who He is. Thanksgiving is honoring God for what He's done. We ought to be doing both. Keep doing good works. Keep sharing your resources. Let's do these things. If you start to listen, you'll realize the Bible has a whole lot of lettuce. It's not somebody pointing their finger and scolding. It's rather the encouragement. Let's come together. Let's be each other's encouragement. And together we'll do things individually we can never do. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Father, we thank You for the time You've given us today. And I thank You today for the lettuce leaves that You've dropped in Scripture, most especially in this part of Hebrews. And I pray that You would let those encouragements come alive in our hearts, that we can begin to be brother and sister to each other, encouraging each other and working with others to do the work that You've set before us to do. We know that some of us today are dealing with some pretty heavy things. You know who those persons are, and You've heard us pray with some of them. We pray that You would continue to work in their lives and work in our lives so that we can know the right things to do at the right times. All this we pray in Your Son's name. Amen.